Hey, everybody. It's rare these days that I get to record with guests in person, but I was able to record this week's episode in person as I was filming video for Bethany B. Wilkinson's book launch for her new book, The Diversity Gap, Where Good Intentions Meet True Cultural Change. Listen in as Bethany talks about the creative process behind her book, advice that she would give women of color as they navigate workspaces, and how she cares for herself as a Black woman leader. Check it out. Everybody, welcome to a book celebration.
Yes.
This is a celebration, okay? Mm-hmm. I'm happy to be your host. I am spoken word poet and host of the podcast Her with Amina Brown, and I am Amina Brown, so that worked out pretty good, right? Mm-hmm. And we are here to be in conversation with Bethany B. Wilkinson, author of, and I'm going to hold this book up, 10,000 times. Do y'all understand me? I'm going to hold this up as many times as I can, because every time I hold it up, I want you to think, I need to buy five of those. I know five people that need this book. I need to buy 10 of those. Okay. We're here with Bethany B. Wilkinson, author of The Diversity Gap, Where Good Intentions Meet True Cultural Change. And I'm excited to be your host today, not only because I respect Bethany's work so much, but also because she's my friend.
Yes.
So our time together today is going to be a combination of book event,
mm-hmm.
conversation, and girlfriend time. That is what we're bringing you.
That's it.
So, Bethany, talk to me. This is a big accomplishment. Like, your book is out. Like, these are my out fingers. Your
yeah.
book is out now. Okay? It's out now.
Uh-huh.
How do you feel?
That is a big question. And a good one. I feel a lot of things. I feel so many things. Firstly, just humbled and honored and grateful to be in conversation with you, because I admire you so much. And you've been such a big part of my book writing journey, just as a person, as a creative. But I feel excited. I'm excited for people to read it. I'm excited for people to grapple with the ideas, to explore what it looks like to apply those ideas. I am nervous, because writing a book where you talk about racism and white supremacy in 2021 can be stressful. You never know what the people are going to say or do, or how the internet's going to respond. So I'm a little nervous about that. I feel grateful. I feel ready. I feel ready for this moment. I feel like it's been a long time coming. Lots of hours, lots of tears, lots of emotional work and labor and release and relief even. And so I feel ready. I'm here.
I love that. I love that ready is the word that mm-hmm. came to your mind. I love that. That feels so powerful.
Mm.
And I want to talk a little bit about the process that led to this book, because you and I both, as writers, remember the moments where we would be at someone else's event, you know, watching them tell their story about their book.
Mm-hmm.
And I would feel this thing inside, like, oh, I know I'm supposed to write books too. Wow, like the dream inside, right? And for me, for a while, not knowing that many authors, to be able to find out how does the process actually happen, right? How does it just go from being like a dream maybe you had when you were a little girl or at some other point in life to now, like, this is reality. So take us back. How did you arrive at the point where you were like, I'm going to write a book? What mm-hmm. was that process like?
Yeah. So I wanted to write a book for a long time. I think my whole life. Love writing. English was always my jam. It's the gift that I love to bring to the world, always. So I knew I wanted to write a book probably from the time I was really little. But as I became an adult, it was this very mysterious process. You know, it seems like there's this group of people and they had the book writing class in high school. I missed that class. But I would say there were a couple of experiences that really shifted that for me. One was hearing you actually speak at an event in 2016, where you unpacked how it's as a writer, it's important to create a book proposal, because that helps you know if you have enough that to actually fill a book, or is it just a blog post, or is it an ebook? That framing really helped me, because I was like, I have a lot of things to say, but do I have enough to say to fill a book, and then what size book? So making that really practical decision was important. Like, okay, I need to have enough to say to fill a book. But then also I had another mentor tell me, hey, Bethany, authors are people who have something to say. So what do you want to say? And when it came down to it, I was like, well, I have a lot of thoughts and opinions, but what I want to say right now is that, hello, people, racism's the problem in your organizations. It's not just recruiting diverse talent. At the time, that was the thing that I had a lot to say about. And so thinking through all these different pieces, I was like, okay, I'm ready because I have something to say. I think I have enough to say to fill an entire book. And that was probably in 2017, 2018 that I came to that conclusion.
Okay. So I want to talk about the journey from, I think I'm going to write a book mm-hmm. to, I know it's going to be about the diversity gap. I remember my last book, the frame of the book came to me first, that I knew how the chapters, how I wanted chapters to be structured and all those things. And then I was like, crap, what am I going to say?
Yeah, sure.
I thought about the frame of this. Uh-huh. What am I going to say? And then it took like a moment in life where I knew it is this that is supposed to go in the frame of that book.
Sure.
So you had these ideas because you were already doing work in, I guess what we would now call in sort of corporate or nonprofit type of world in DEI and diversity, equity, inclusion. You're already doing some work mm-hmm. there in what would be in some sort of faith-based spaces would be considered racial reconciliation work, yeah. right? You're already doing some of that work there. So you had an inkling like something in this is a book. How did you know the diversity gap is what this book was going to be?
I think part of that was listening closely to my own experience. I lived the diversity gap before I wrote about it, being the first or only Black woman on these teams and these organizations, constantly or regularly having to or choosing to speak into the racial dynamics of those places. I was living it. And so it made sense to me to expound upon that. I would also say that I had some training in it through my education and then just my experience, right? So I had a day where I sat down with index cards. This process might work for some people. It might not work for others, but it worked for me. Where I took index cards, 3x5 index cards, I bought a little box, and I just wrote out every idea, every author, every thought leader, every reference I had in just my body, in my mind related to race, racial justice, organizational culture, and leadership. And I had hundreds of cards by the end of writing them all down. And then I sorted them all into categories. I did that probably a couple times to see, okay, what's really sticking out, what's not. And then I started to piece them together. And so it was an iterative process of listening to my own experience, listening to the tensions, I would say, of other people around me as well, because I wanted to create something that I knew would be helpful, and then organizing what I knew based on what I'd read and heard. And I'm a big learner and I'm very curious. So I just needed to pull it all together. And then I was honestly driving down the road one day on my way to go meet a friend when the title, The Diversity Gap, came to me. And so it wasn't that I knew that was going to happen. It was just like, what should I call this? And I don't know where it came from. It just dropped in my spirit while I was driving to Decatur.
I love that because I do remember before writing a book, people saying things to me like it will just come to you, certain things. And that would just sound so strange mm-hmm. and very mysterious and not practical at all to mm-hmm. me when they say those things. But that is a part of the book writing process, that there are these sort of mysterious moments in a way that like it comes to you mm-hmm. and like your soul knows
yes.
this is what is next, a part of the mm-hmm. process, or this is what this is supposed to be. Even if you don't have all of the details yet, you know, you didn't have all the details when the diversity gap came to you. But I love that. Mm-hmm. And I love that that mystery is a part of it. Sometimes I wish it wasn't because yeah. I love to have a lot of plans that are going to work out same. Exactly the way I plan them. It's like better for me.
Mm-hmm.
But writing a book's not like that. Mm-mm. You know, you can make lots of plans. You know, I mean, you can have all of your outline and everything, and you have to be prepared that in the process, there will obviously be some moments.
Absolutely. And I'm also a big fan of checking for what resonates with people. When I said the diversity gap to people, they got it without too much explanation. And I was looking for something that would be that simple because I knew that the diversity gap as a project, as an initiative, would exist along multiple platforms. I have a podcast, I have event series, that sort of thing. So it was helpful once it did drop to find that it resonated with others. I think that was an important part of my process.
Yeah, no, I get that. Let me ask about your book writing process. And this is just a nosy curiosity of mine. I would like to know, what were the things that you needed when you were writing this book? What were the must-haves once you got into the writing process? Okay, I'll tell you a couple of mine. I craved a lot of carbohydrates whenever I'm in book writing mode. And then discovered that I can't exist on carbohydrates.
Not alone.
Alone. You know, I can exist for a time. But brownies is not a solid nutrient. It just, you know.
Is it though? I mean, it might be.
Yeah. And like, it needs other things.
Sure.
To supplement it. Especially if that's what you're doing every day, right? But I just needed like, I think now that I think about it, maybe I needed something that was bringing like a comfort to me or something.
Yeah.
So that was brownies for a while. And then I was like, let me downgrade to dark chocolate, which at least has antioxidants.
Yes, some nutritional benefit. Though I think butter and brownies does too, but I hear you.
It was nutritional to my soul at the very least. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I want to know from you, what were the things? Could be the snacks that you remember being your must-haves or you're writing this. Could be, was there music that you were listening to at the time? Like, give us a little window into that part.
For me, it was all environmental.
Okay.
So I needed my space heater. And if I couldn't have my space heater, I needed my heated blanket. Something about the warmth helped me get snuggled in and comfortable. No matter what the temperature was outside, I needed those things. I also needed a candle. That just kind of, and it still does, it just brings me into the moment and helps me focus. So that was a big part of my process. I love a good glass of wine. So similar to the brownies, you got to rein it in after a period of time. Mm-hmm. But a good glass of wine would be really great. And then of course, coffee if it's morning time. So most of my things were environmental. Give me the warmth, give me the space heater, give me the cozy, and then my candle.
Ooh, I love that. Mm-hmm. I love that. I actually had a friend tell me that lighting a candle is a part of her writing process. And I had never done that until recently. And I was like, oh, it does feel nice.
It does something. Yeah. It's like, it sets the intention.
Mm-hmm. Just that moment of like watching, like, it's sort of like containable fire. I think there's something to that and the writing process and that writing a book really, and I'm interested to hear your thoughts on this because for me, because my books more so they were lending themselves to more of a memoir kind of style.
Sure.
I felt like I was digging into my soul a lot and I didn't account for how hard that was going to be. Did you feel that in writing this book as well? Because this book was based on your research.
Yep.
And it was based on your lived experience in a lot of work environments. Did you feel that like, what's going on here? Feel.
Yes. I really love that you're asking this question because I think about it a lot in retrospect. I think there's a phenomenon in the world, in organizations where the experiences, the trauma of Black people and specifically Black women is kind of manipulated, it's gawked at in a way that's really unhealthy and dysfunctional. And I had to be really focused on protecting myself. Like I needed boundaries, like every part of my story, I don't owe that to leaders. I just don't owe that to them.
Yeah.
And I don't want my story to be used or commodified. And then there are other parts of my story that do really illustrate these points in ways that I need to illustrate some of these points. So it was a give and take, a push and pull for me because I was trying to not feed into the unhealthy reliance on Black people's trauma to educate white folks and leaders while also telling the truth of our experiences. And so in some moments it was too much and I was like, that's for the journal and for therapy. That's not for the world. And then there are other times where I could tell like, okay, I can share the story. I think it's the right one for me to give away. So I had to navigate those boundaries.
Oh, that's so smart. That's so smart and so wise and something that I hope I think about the next time that I write a book because I did not do that in my first experiences there. And that sort of came back to bite me in some ways. I remember being in therapy post the book coming out. And of course, my therapist was like, please remain in therapy while you're writing your next book. But she was also like, do that so that you can have the tools to weigh out, to be in a healthy place to weigh out
what is, some things we write are healing for us, even if they're never meant to be in the public.
Yep.
And then there are some things that we write that were healing for us at a time that we now feel in a place where we want to share that because we think it will be helpful for other people. Mm-hmm. But it does take being in a healthy place as a writer to be able to discern that. So I'm so glad that you were able to do that.
Well, it's interesting because I was writing a lot of it during summer 2020. And so I was having to make sense of my experience as a Black woman in a lot of different places, in a lot of different ways, and watching other authors, other Black folks share their experiences. I feel like I was a part of a broader community that, and we were all sorting out what's for me, what's for them, what's healing, what's re-traumatizing. And so I was privy to those conversations, and it helped me to decide how I wanted to show up to this particular project because I had all of that online interaction, if nothing else.
Yeah, yeah. I want to talk a little bit more about the content that's inside this book because some of the people that are watching this, they've got their books in hand already. Mm-hmm. And some people that are tuning into this or will be listening to this, this will be their, oh, I need to get this book, right? Mm-hmm. And I remember the first time I heard you sharing the content from the Diversity Gap research. And I felt very emotional after your presentation. And I'm sure I felt that for layers of reasons. Obviously, I felt it partly because you're my friend. And I was just so proud of you because it was so brilliant. And getting to see that brilliance really expanded upon in this book was just wonderful to read. But my first time seeing you sort of share this, share that this is why I'm calling this the Diversity Gap. This is what the people of color I interviewed said their workplaces were like when they were there thriving. I remember that was a big part of your presentation. And it was so wonderful to me, first of all, to hear about people of color thriving in their workplaces. Mm-hmm. So that had me like, okay, hearing that other people of color are saying this and your research says it's possible for there to be workplaces that are equitable, mm-hmm. that are as safe can be for people of color in America, right? So I felt this like, oh my gosh, I'm so proud of her. Oh my gosh, I'm glad that this like could exist. I'm glad that there's going to be tools, right, to help people who are like, it doesn't exist at our workplace right now. So I want you to answer for us, what do you want people who read this to gain from it? There are going to be a lot of leaders reading this book. And there are a lot of leaders who need to know about this book so they can read it, right? And they're just going to be people, whether they are in those leadership, hiring, C-suite positions,
yep.
they're going to be people reading this also who felt like I felt very seen. I felt very heard and understood by the information you were rolling out to us, you know, at this event. So talk about that. What do you want people to gain from this? When somebody gets to, they get all the way to the index, mm-hmm. this book. They read it from the dedication and they made mm-hmm. it to the index.
Mm-hmm.
What are you hoping they walk away with?
I want them to walk away with a commitment to understanding the impact of their good intentions. And I want them to know that there are action steps they can take today to start creating an environment that is more dignifying and humanizing and celebratory and dignifying of people of color in their workplace. And this is kind of a second thing I want them to know, but I also want them to know that the issues we're facing exist beyond the four walls of the institution they're leading. They're societal, they're structural, they're systemic. And I don't say that to be overwhelming. I think a lot of times that makes people think, oh, wow, I can't do anything about that. But it's no, it's just like you have to know what you're dealing with. You have to name it honestly to figure out your next best step in that direction. At the end of the book, I share, so I lay out all the things in the book, but at the end of the book, I share a section on experiments and strategies because I wanted to give everything I've seen and learned and heard about to the audience to say, hey, everything in this book's not for you. Like, take what works for you, scrap what doesn't, but find what works in your context. And I want people to understand the big picture and then have access to the tools to go do something about it.
That's one of my favorite things about this book is how practical it is and how it is really moving folks beyond what can be, I think, for some people, what we hope are the feel-good conversations, mm-hmm. right? What we hope are, I mean, this is me telling my age a little, Bethany, but what we hope is the United Colors of Benetton, you know, uh-huh. of this moment. What we hope is the kumbaya that mm-hmm. because we all sat at a table and we ate injera mm-hmm. together mm-hmm. and we had a beautiful conversation. You told me what makes you different from me. Mm-hmm. And I told you what makes me different from you. We think that's the work. And I love in this book that you are laying out that that is the very, very tip mm-hmm. of the real work that we yes. need to get to. We need to not be so focused on what makes us feel good or feel better, but we actually need to look at the systems and practices of what we're doing mm-hmm. in our work teams, how we actually make things more equitable.
Yes.
And that's going to take some leadership and mm-hmm. some choices and some probably unpopular, uncomfortable decisions depending on the institution.
Yes.
So let's get into the book. The people need to hear a sample, mm-hmm. a passage, Bethany. Can you pick one of your, I mean, it's hard to say, right? What is a favorite passage uh-huh. in a whole book that you wrote?
I know.
But can you pick a passage that you would love to share with us? Mm-hmm. Give us a little glimpse of some things that are in this book.
Yes, absolutely. So one of my favorite chapters, which is it's like choosing from your children, but one of my favorite chapters is the second one, and it's all about impact over intentions. And in this chapter, I share direct quotes from people I interviewed about their experiences in their majority white cultural context and organization. So I want to read a little bit of what one woman said, and then I want to read some of me aggregating things that all of them said. So this is a Black woman who works for a national faith-based nonprofit. In many of her roles, she was the only Black person on her team. Over time, she has intentionally worked to shift her role within the organization to focus on working with other Black folks and other underrepresented racial minorities. So she's pivoting while she's working in this one organization. My question to her was, if you could tell your white peers one thing without fear of being misunderstood or silenced, what would it be? And she said, this is her quote, she says, "You will never understand the real cost of being in my body within this white space. Recognize there is a cost, a holistic cost. For you, you just have to show up to work each day. But for me and for other non-white folks, we have to show up to work and deal with your microaggressions and deal with creating strategy for all the people of color and do our jobs excellently because we know we're going to be judged harsher. We end up saying yes to doing more work because we're often the only people of color in the organization. It can pile so high to the point where it has a holistic cost on my emotional, psychological, and physical well-being. And white folks cannot understand this cost. Yes, I have agency, and yes, I'm learning to make different decisions, but the cost is real, and you are part of that cost. I don't want you to feel sorry for me, but you need to do something different in your very being in order to change who we are as an organization and how we function, because I'm human." Yeah.
Hmm.
So later on, I go on to say, "Many interviewees gave voice to the extra emotional labor required to simply do our jobs at work every day. I say our because this is my experience too. There is the emotional labor of smiling through uncomfortable and offensive interactions, the emotional labor of managing our own biases and the biases of others, the emotional labor of suppressing our counter narratives to be seen as a team player, the emotional labor of downplaying our true thoughts and feelings to avoid being stereotyped as angry or difficult. There is also the emotional and psychological toll of having to work out the sadness, anger, frustration, and disrespect we feel on an ongoing basis while trying to maintain perfect composure on the outside. This is, of course, on top of doing the job we are paid to do." What would it take to create environments where people of color can do their best work without the ongoing distraction and burden of racism and white supremacy culture?
I just feel my feelings. I feel my feelings because one of the other things I loved about the book, Bethany, that I think is a part of actually doing this work, actually doing the work of seeing that eventually there is no diversity gap, is it requires imagination.
Mm-hmm.
It requires reimagining how we work.
Yes.
And I think when we think about diversity, equity, inclusion, justice, when we think about that work, especially if we haven't been participating in it, we're thinking about it in, is it about the numbers? Is it about the number of people that fit these slots, you know, that I have?
Mm-hmm.
Is it about this, you know, strategy that I can write down somewhere or put in a caption on social media, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there is creativity to this as well, because we get a chance to reimagine. I love that thought. It's a powerful thing to think about, what would this place be like if there were not racism or white supremacy? And maybe in this lifetime or in another, however many lifetimes,
sure,
maybe there will never be a world exactly 0% that. But the fact that we can lead ourselves to imagining that means we get as close as we can.
Mm-hmm.
We do that in our lifetime.
Yes.
So that the leaders after us can do what they can do in their lifetime. And I love that imagination is a part of this too.
Yes. There are so many questions sprinkled throughout the book that I don't answer because I do think it's different for everyone, but I do want to evoke that imagination. I do want us to step back and think, what does this mean for us? Yes, maybe it means starting, you know, a DEI task force. Those can be helpful, research shows, but maybe it's about how you plan your team outings and who's invited to those. And is it affordable? Is it the sort of activity that one cultural group prefers over another? Everybody's not trying to go hiking. Everybody's not trying to go bowling. Everybody doesn't drink beer. You know, some people don't have that flexibility in their schedules because they're, you know, taking care of kids, whatever it might be. So some of it is through, you know, those formal diversity, equity, inclusion channels. But I find that a lot of it is all the other stuff. Yeah.
I'll tell you something that I've been dreaming about. This is connected, but it's a little bit of a random thought. I still want to share it with you and get your thoughts on it. I was telling someone recently, if I ever have a company where I have like multiple employees, I was like, I would love to have Black Woman Days that are only for Black women employees, but it's not a sick day and it's not your PTO. It's a separate bank of days and that you could call in sometimes and just be like, I need a Black Woman Day.
Wow. That stretches my imagination, Amina. I'm like, okay, I love this. There's no HR, right? So you can do that.
And be like, I mean, Black women need a day, a week. We need our time, okay? And I wish I had that I could like dole it out in some way. I thought about that recently. Yeah. I'm just thinking about reimagining things because I was talking to a friend of mine and we were talking about all the things that Black women carry, right? In our workspaces, in our personal lives, you know, and that was just, it was a funny, but like real thought that I was like,
oh, I love it.
I wish, can we get a Black Woman Day?
Mm-hmm.
Just like,
it's, here you go.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Because at first I was like, it could be like Juneteenth. And I was like, no. Okay. It needs to be at my choice, at the choice of the Black woman, which she can take the day.
Yeah. Yes. I think that's a great idea. I've seen organizations set aside intentional funds to send their employees who are having like a minority experience of a variety of identities.
Sure.
Like they get to go be a part of communities that support them and it's paid for by the organization or the company. Like, I don't think that's a stretch.
I'm going to work on this. We're going to work on this. This is how we're going to work on the diversity gap as well. Okay. I want to ask some advice questions.
Great.
And some of these you are covering here in the book. So I know some of your answers will be here in this book that you too can have yourself. Okay. Let's start with this. If a woman of color is being interviewed for a job and in the interview process, right? In a typical average interview process, You're going to possibly have multiple interviews with different leaders in the company. You may actually tour the facility at some point and see kind of what the lay of the land is like, which means you may get a view on the other people who work there, right? What are some things as a woman of color that you would tell another woman of color, here's some things you should think about when you're considering going into work for a company? Because I have had some moments where there were a lot of things I didn't consider.
Yeah.
And then I got hired or got asked to be a contractor. So in a way, I wasn't full-time there, but it was still a place I worked pretty consistently, right? And then I got in there and was like, I can't. So now when I talk with other women of color, and for the women of color who may be watching or listening now, having some tools, what are a couple of those tools you would say if you're considering working for a company and you want to know, is this the place for you as a woman of color? What are those couple of things you would say, think about this?
Yeah, the first thing that comes to mind is to assess how much you have to code switch to go to the interview. And so if you are feeling the need to tone down the color of your nails or how you style your hair or what you would naturally wear to the workplace, I'm not saying that's a deal breaker. I'm just saying be mindful of how you are already sensing you need to show up to this space because that's data for you. Of course, when you get there, I would say, who else is here? Is there anyone else who looks like me in this space? Is there anyone that looks like me in this space? And what might that mean? Because if you are the first or one of the few, that will have an extra toll, an extra layer of work added. If you aren't mindful of it, people just put expectations on you that you might not even put on yourself. So that's something to pay attention to. I would also say pay attention to whether or not they are treating you like you're exceptional. And this is a tricky one. Because it feels good to be exceptional and remarkable, especially when you are trying to get a job. Yes, that makes sense. It's important you want to stand out. But I have found in situations where people have been like, oh, we're trying to diversify and we need you. We need your voice. We need your perspective. I get it. And on a level, I appreciate it. But it also might mean that they're expecting me to perform, especially as like the diversity person, in ways that I actually don't want to. Maybe I just want to show up and do my marketing job. Or, you know, maybe I don't want to be tasked with leading all the diversity, equity, inclusion things or responding in the middle of a racial crisis. And so just, you know, be mindful of how that's shaping you, how that is sitting in your body, you know, when you are in those conversations.
Let me ask you about this as a second advice question. And I feel tender asking it because I remember having been in many situations like this. I want to get your advice on what women of color should do or how they know when it's time to leave a place. And I have worked quite a few places that I maybe should have left sooner. It took some girlfriends. It took some therapy to be like, you know, you can leave there.
Yeah.
And I do want to say as a caveat, and you and I've talked about this, it's not everyone's position to have the privilege to leave.
Right.
That there will be some people that will be working in an environment that is very toxic, that will be working in an environment where the diversity gap is wide.
Yep.
And nothing is being done about that. And they may not have the privilege to leave. And so I want to speak to that first, that there may be people watching us right now who are like, I'm not going to have that privilege. I've got to stay. And maybe we'll address that in a little bit too, but I want to speak to it so we can honor that. For the people, and we're asking this particularly about women of color, for the women of color who would have the possibility to leave, how do you know when it's time? What are two or three things that you should maybe notice? Could be in yourself, could be in the organization that would say, you might want to consider that this is no longer the place for you.
So many things come to mind. Honestly, I am the person who tends to stay too long. And so it's like the flags are glaring and red and bright. I've pushed past my actual limits typically. Some of those signs are often in my body. So it's not always rational. It's health things, it's anxiety, it's inability to sleep, those just general health and wellness factors tend to go awry, or that's what I've observed in my own experience. But before it gets to that point, if your body hasn't told you yet, I think I'm a big fan of intuition in general. As a woman of colors, like, you have an intuition about things, and sometimes it's work for some of us to learn to trust it or to even listen to that intuition, but you can kind of sense things about people or situations that might be data for you if you think it might be time to go. If you've been in a position where you have gone through all the channels you can to raise issues or problems, especially if they're diversity, equity, inclusion related, and it's been months or years and no one's acted on those. It's Maya Angelou quote. When someone shows you who they are, believe them the first time.
Yeah.
That would have saved me lots of trouble.
Okay.
Watching how other women of color are experiencing that environment. Are they staying? Are they leaving? When they leave, is it an emotional, dramatic uproar? Is it something that the organization quietly tucks under the rug? Like, to be curious about those stories, because I think oftentimes, especially if you're one of the few Black people who's there, or women of color who's there, there have probably been others. And so curiosity about that can help inform whether or not it's time to stay or time to go. But I'm a big believer that your body tells the truth and your body knows. And whether it's like the quiet nudges that you feel after an interaction with a supervisor, or big things, bigger health problems that show up in your life, I think your body will tell you, honestly.
Oh, that's so good. And I didn't plan to ask you this, but I would love to have you speak to it. For the people who may be in that in-between, that they're in a job, at a company, in an organization that they would love to leave, but they can't.
Yeah.
Are there things you would say, particularly to women of color? This can apply also to people who are just from other marginalized groups as well. Yeah. When you're in that in-between of, this is where I am, this is what I got to do to pay my bills right now, to take care of myself. But how do you navigate that while you're in an environment that is not the healthiest for you?
Mm-hmm. First thing is to pull back from the DEI work in that workplace. If you're on that committee because you're one of the few and you're trying to change the world, I think divesting from the organization's DEI work is important for your mental health, especially if they're not trying to actually change anything for real. They just want it there on their website to stamp it off. So that's one thing. I would also say, or encourage you to evaluate what other boundaries you have with work. Are you overperforming? Are you working harder than the white folks on your team? And if so, how much harder? Is everyone losing sleep, or is it just you? Is everyone staying late, or is it just you? I think as people of color, we can, and we often have been trained to or taught to for survival, oftentimes to overwork. And I think we have to do some healing work around that to rein that in, to make it more manageable. Are you picking up someone else's slack? Just to be mindful of those dynamics. And some of this, I'm saying it, but truth be told, I've needed a community to work through some of these things. It's not just me and my journal sorting through the stuff in my mind. It's me with a spiritual director, with a coach, with a therapist, with Amina and friends, you know, like helping me piece this together. So, but think about that. Where can you pull back and still be doing your job? And then also, you have to prioritize, I think, in as much as you have the resources, you have to prioritize filling your life with other life-giving things. Mm. And so what are you doing before you get to the office? How are you living after you leave the office? What can you be doing to cultivate a rich life outside of your job, to help sustain you, to help heal you, to help inspire you as you, you know, bridge into what's next?
Mm, this leads well into the next question I wanted to ask you, which is, how do you care for yourself as a Black woman leader? And I wanted to be very specific what I mean, because I know that the term self-care, for example, has a lot of definitions. Everybody has a lot of definitions, how they think about that. I think a lot of that definition falls into pampering for some folks, right? And one should pamper oneself as much as one wants to pamper oneself. But I think there is also a very holistic view of what it means to care for yourself. And could that be bath bombs? It could. Could it be saying no to opportunities that you don't think are a good fit for you? It could be that. Could it be drawing boundaries in unhealthy relationships? It could be that. What are those things that are how you care for yourself as a Black woman leader? And in particular, as a Black woman leader who has been in this space of talking about racial justice, of talking about diversity, equity, inclusion, I feel like all Black women need a layer of how we care for ourselves.
Yeah.
There are additional layers when you do this work mm-hmm. required for the diversity gap. Mm-hmm. Talk to us about that.
Yes. So I love this question. For me, it looks like creating a life I love outside of this work. And that largely involves a homestead that I'm cultivating with my husband. And so a couple of years ago, before the diversity gap, I knew that I wanted to eventually retreat to some farm place in the middle of nowhere. And I don't think I always knew why I felt that pull. Part of it is because I grew up on a farm. But I think inside, like my body's wisdom knew that if I was going to show up to this really painful work related to race and justice, then I would need an anchor that was inherently nourishing to me. And so we recently purchased an acre of land and we have been building a house. It's almost done. And it's just this beautiful acre in middle Georgia. You won't be able to find me. And the internet barely works unless you have great service, which I do, but I can turn it off. Like I just needed, for Bethany, self-care looks like having a home base that does not care how many emails I send, doesn't care how many downloads my podcast gets. Like it doesn't matter. The chickens need you to go collect their eggs. You know, like the home, it needs maintenance and it doesn't care about the things that are happening online on the screen. And I needed that. I needed a completely different universe that I can live in and cultivate. And so that has been the biggest thing for me. I would say secondly, has been deepening into community with other Black women who are healing. And I don't even know if I have words to describe how unbelievably restorative that has been for every part of my life. It's just been everything. When you can show up to a space, you don't have to explain a thing and don't have to perform. You don't have to be magical.
Yeah.
You don't have to be Wonder Woman. You can just be. And that has been everything for me.
Oh, I resonate with that because you're a part of that community with me. And for so long, having been, you know, the lone Black woman in certain spaces, the lone woman in certain spaces sometimes, I didn't have that community with other Black women. And the last 5 years of life building that has been so life-giving, even when I was still working in a lot of spaces where I was one of a small number of Black women there or the only Black woman there, it was like I still felt like even though I look around and I don't see Black women here, like in my life, I felt like I had a squad
yep.
of that support. And that is such a big part of that care. And I'm so glad that you have been a part of that for me, that we got to do some of that together has been so wonderful. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about what is next for Bethany B. Wilkinson, okay? And I want to qualify what I mean when I ask this, because you and I have gone to a lot of conferences, a lot of professional conferences together. And, you know, you get in the green room or in whatever the little networking thing is. And that was always the big question. Well, what's next? What do you have going on? What's next? Uh-huh. What's going on? What are you doing? What are you up to? You know? And for so many years, I just felt so obligated, you know, to have some sort of like amazing thing to say that I was going to do. And so I want you to know that I'm not asking from that
yep.
lens. This is not a productivity question. This is not this is done. What's the next thing you're going to be doing, Bethany? This is not a productivity question. It's more of a soul question. Mm-hmm. What is this season of life now versus what the season of life was that you may have been in when you're working on your book? I think that's the weird thing about writing books too. Is you're in a certain season of life when you sort of pitch the idea.
Yep.
And then you're in a totally different season of life when you actually write it. Mm-hmm. And then you're in a totally different season of life when it actually is out there for other people to read, right?
So true.
So tell us, what is next for you? What are you dreaming up right now? What is bringing you joy?
Mm-hmm. What's next? So I mentioned the homestead. That's going to be a lot of what's next as our house is finished. And I'm really open-handed about what all that means. It's a new town for me. And I want to know my people, you know, in a place. And I'm hoping that the pandemic ends one day. And so I'll be able to go out and build relationships in my new town. So that's a big thing for me. I'm really wanting to enter a season of rest. Mm. And I do rest. I'm not going to lie. I'm grateful that I've been able to design a life where I take a lot of breaks, maybe too many, some would say, truth be told. But I'm excited to have an extended season of focusing on this, like just being in one space and cultivating nourishment and even sanctuary is a word I've been sitting with. Like, what would it look like to have a safe and healing place for Bethany as a Black woman? And then beyond that, I'm dreaming about what it would look like to create those sorts of spaces for other Black women in general, where we can be with each other, commune with the land. I know I sound like a hippie because I kind of am, which might be surprising because I wrote this book on like organizational culture and leadership, but this is just the truth of who I am. So I'm really dreaming about space and place and land and community. And what does it mean to be a part of that? And how can I invite more people into that for our healing as people? I think reading or writing this book and reading about race a lot in general, I'm like, okay, we've got the problem for many, like my book or all the other books, like we have a pretty good working understanding of the problem. And now I want to focus my energy on being a part of creating those environments where we can experience healing just for the sake of our own lives and stories, not for the sake of transforming organizations.
Right, right. I love what's next. That sounds amazing. Do you have any final words that you want to share with the people, the community of folks that are watching or listening? What's in your mind right now when you think about sort of closing this time of us getting to celebrate that you did this? You sat down, you wrote a book that's going to be very helpful for so many people, and it wasn't easy. Mm-hmm. And you wrote it during a time that had a lot of layers of being difficult.
Yeah.
So we're celebrating that. We're celebrating you. We're encouraging people to dig into this work.
Yeah.
What are your final words you'd say to the community?
I would say that the journey is the work. And yes, there is a destination that I dream about, you know, that place where the diversity gap is closed. But as I reflect on my own experience of writing this book and all of the lessons I've learned as a human in relationships, in leadership, in organizational life, it's all the work. And it's just the daily choice to say yes to it, the willingness to see our racial dynamics, the willingness to see other people, the willingness to ask the hard questions. That's what the work is. And it's a lifelong journey, but it's also beautiful and you learn a ton. So my encouragement would be to opt in to the work. And it looks different for all of us. That's what's tricky about it. It's easy to stand outside and say, this is what it should look like for you, or post this thing, or, you know, go to this thing. But really deepening into our own stories and knowing that the journey is the work is what I want to encourage people to do.
Big, big thank you to Bethany B. Wilkinson for being a part of the Her Living Room this week. And big thank you to you for being a part of the Her Living Room. Bethany's book, The Diversity Gap, Where Good Intentions Meet True Cultural Change, is out now. These are my out now fingers. Can't see them, but they're happening, okay? You can get a copy wherever books are sold, but be cool and get Bethany's book from your favorite independent bookseller. For more info about Bethany and her book, visit thediversitygap.com. Her with Amina Brown is produced by Matt Owen for Soul Graffiti Productions as a part of the Seneca Women Podcast Network in partnership with iHeartRadio. Thanks for listening. And don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast.